Let's pretend this morning that you have decided to read the Bible straight through from Genesis to Revelation. Not a very good idea, I think, since the Bible was not written in its present order, but something thousands of people have tried to do. There are some difficult moments in Genesis, but enough good stories to keep you going. Exodus starts out with a bang, with the plagues and the grand escape from Egypt, but then rather quickly bogs down in catalogs of legal codes, directions about how to make a lampstand, and how to build a covenant box, and how to style the priestly robes. Things like this: if a man steals a cow or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he must pay 5 cows for 1 cow and 4 sheep for 1 sheep. Not exactly the kind of fascinating literature my friend Tom Brock is going to read tonight before he falls asleep. Leviticus is mostly dreadful. Numbers is not much better. And Deuteronomy, only a slight improvement for modern readers who want a good story and who get bored in a hurry with dusty antiques and the fine points of ancient theology. But then you come to the books of Joshua and Judges, so horrendously full of violence and killings that your hands get covered with blood, but exciting in a morbid kind of way. Holy war being waged against the natives of Palestine by the elect children of God who believed it was their destiny to snatch the land for themselves. In place of those original dispossessed Canaanites, you might read Cherokee and Sioux, Choctaw and Comanche. And in place of the invading Hebrews, you might read our own forefathers taking control of the great plains in the name of manifest destiny, and you get the picture. If something close to genocide in the name of God thrills you, Joshua and Judges are the books to read. But what an incredible change of pace when you turn the page to the next book. So short, it has only 4 chapters, one of the most gentle and idyllic little stories in all the literature of the world, and called after its heroine, Ruth. It begins quickly with a famine in Israel so severe that a Jewish man and his wife and their 2 sons have to walk over into the land of Moab, 40 or 50 miles east, to find food. 10 years pass, the husband and the sons die, and the widow, Naomi, is left alone with the 2 foreign girls her sons had married. It's a risky place for her, with no protection, and when word comes that things are better now back home, she decides to return. The girls both say they'll go with her, but she tells them this is foolish, that they should stay at home and find themselves new husbands. One of them is a nice girl who does what she is told. The other is Ruth, who is better than nice, a girl who seems to love her mother-in-law enough to argue with her. Naomi says, "Be smart, Ruth. Your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You do the same." People thought that their gods were limited to the land where they were worshipped. If you left home, you left the sovereignty of your God. We think of the Bible as strictly monotheistic, but some of the writers freely admitted there were other gods, just not on a par with their own God. So you hear the 86th Psalm saying, "There is none like you among the gods, O Lord." And the 97th Psalm saying, "You are exalted far above all gods." So Orpah, one of the sisters, goes back to her god, Chemosh, but Ruth decides to switch. She delivers her famous speech, used in its 17th century English form in countless weddings. And Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried." Before that passionate plea, Naomi surrenders, and the two women walk their 50-mile journey around the end of the Dead Sea and back to the little village of Bethlehem from which Naomi had set out years before with a husband and two bachelor sons. When her old friends greet her in happy surprise, calling her by her name, she cries out in sorrow, "Don't call me Naomi." The word means joy or pleasure. "Call me Mara," bitter, "because God has dealt harshly with me." Actually, the wordplay is a little more extensive than that. The author of this superb little short story seems to use paronomasia or punning on each character name as well as on some of the things he says. James Moffat, one of the few translators who tries to bring these Hebrew puns into English, has Naomi say, "Call me Mara, for the Almighty has cruelly marred me. I left this place full, and the Eternal has brought me back empty." Around their campfires, over the centuries, the Jewish audience must have loved this suspenseful story and the way it played with their native vocabulary, not a newspaper story or a record of history, but a conscious work of art. Naomi blames God for what has happened to her because there isn't anyone else to blame. In those days, God caused everything, good or bad. There was no devil to accuse, nor was there any real understanding of natural law. So God caused the famine. God caused the deaths. For a bitter moment, Naomi forgets the happiness of the old days, the good years in Moab, the loyalty of Ruth, and is sick with self-pity. "I left with husband and sons. I came back with nothing." But it passes, and she and Ruth consider how they are going to live with no husbands to help. It is the time of barley harvest, so Ruth, always courageous, proposes to pick up the leavings in the field of whatever owner will permit this ancient welfare system. By one of those lucky chances you find so often in short stories, she ends up in a field belonging to a relative of Naomi's, a man named Boaz. The Jewish audiences listening to this story will believe, of course, that it was not chance at all, but the providence of God. In any event, when Boaz sees Ruth at work, it appears to be love at first sight. He asks who the new girl is, and his workers tell him that she has been picking up steadily ever since daybreak without resting even for a moment. Jewish gentlemen were often pleased with hard-working women, and Boaz is unusually gentle with this one. He says, "Listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one. I have told the young men not to molest you, and when you get thirsty, drink the water they have drawn." This is unusual treatment, and the audience smiles at the restraint with which the storyteller shows a man falling head over heels in love. At mealtime, when Ruth is hot and dusty, Boaz invites her to eat their parched grain and to dip pieces of bread into the cool wine. He keeps passing food to her until she is full and has some leftovers, and when she goes back to work, he orders his men to show her even more special favors. Not only could she glean even among the sheaves, which was a no-no, but they were even to pull some of the grain out from the bundles and drop it where she could easily pick it up. Obviously, the boss has been fatally pierced by Cupid's golden arrow. When Ruth comes home that night with almost a bushel of barley and her doggy bag, Naomi is as happy as the mother of a KU girl who has just gotten engaged to a rich boy in his final year of med school. She waits a few days for the magic to put Boaz completely under its spell, and then she springs the trap. That night, she says, Boaz will complete the harvest. There will be lots of food and plenty of wine. And as a result, when he lies down beside the hill of grain to guard it until the next day, he will fall rather soundly asleep. Naomi tells Ruth to take a shower, dab on a little Safari by Ralph Lauren, and go down to the threshing floor. "But don't make yourself known," she says, "until he has finished eating and drinking. Then when he lies down, you tiptoe up, turn back the blanket at his feet, and lie down. He will tell you what to do." It's a pretty blunt proposal of marriage, by which the young woman says, in effect, "Here I am, would you like to marry me?" Scholars guess, correctly, I think, that it was considerably more specific and shocking in its details, long ago when the story was being told. But as it was finally written down, edited for the household reader, it is much more reticent. What Ruth does could be embarrassing if she got the wrong response, but wise old Naomi gives the impression of knowing just when to make a move. And sure enough, Boaz wakes up, finds Ruth beside him, hears her ask for his hand in marriage, thanks her for not chasing the younger guys, and says, "I'm your man." Like so many males, he muffs a chance to be really romantic and explains his eagerness to marry Ruth on a purely practical basis. "For as the whole neighborhood knows," he tells her, "you are a capable woman." You have to remember that romantic love is a medieval invention. Marriage in the Bible is based usually on mutual interests, and common sense. A happy ending for the story now seems inevitable, but that's the very moment when a clever author adds the spice of suspense. Boaz says, "Oh, by the way, there's another fellow who is closer kin to your late husband than I am, and he has the right to marry you if he wishes. I'll have to check things out with him." Well, we haven't heard a word about this gentleman before. I think he pops into the story as a way of creating suspense. After which, Boaz says to Ruth, "Now lie down until the morning." He asks her to leave before daybreak, so no one will see her there and gossip. Ruth has gambled and won. When she returns to Naomi with her tale of what has happened, and with a gift from Boaz of 6 more measures of barley, the older woman, wise in the ways of love, says, "The man will not rest. He will settle the matter today," which he does. And the scripture says, "So Boaz took Ruth and made her his wife. When they came together, the Lord caused her to conceive, and she bore Boaz a son." In those days, the Lord was given full credit for both fertility and barrenness. In the language of the Bible, over and over again, he opened the womb and blessed with a child, or he closed the womb and left a Jewish wife in the most desperate condition she could imagine. No one, by the way, showed the slightest sign of knowing that infertility might be a man's fault. If no child came, the woman got the blame. And I can almost hear somebody muttering, "So what else is new?" But Ruth is lucky, and the women of the village say, "Blessed be the Lord today. The child will give you new life and cherish you in your old age." And that's the story, except for one line which literally explodes at the very end. Not for you, maybe, but for any Jewish audience. The little boy who is named Obed will become the grandfather of the great King David. If you've wondered why this pleasant little story was preserved, this is probably the reason. It would be no more interesting than 1,000 other stories much like it, except for one thing. This little baby will turn out to be King David's grandpa. But it is also possible, and I would like to believe this, that the person who wrote this story wanted to strike a blow at religious prejudice by reminding people that even the great King David had Moabite blood in his veins. Now, if you'd like to know how Jews felt about Moabites, here are a couple of sample sentences from the Bible. "No Moabite, even down to the 10th generation, shall become a member of the Lord's assembly." And another one. "I saw that some Jews had married women from Moab. I argued with them and cursed them. I beat them and tore out their hair." Our feelings about Saddam Hussein are almost friendly compared to the way Jews felt about their neighbors to the east. And yet, the story says, and yet even our greatest national hero had Moabite blood. Therefore, let any Hebrew who hates his neighbor hear the voice of God. I told you once a modern parallel to this story that took place one day in the South African state of Zambia. In the large cities, there was usually a color bar in the European shops. Blacks were told to queue up at a little hatchway and not to enter the shop itself. But in some small town stores, that was not practical, and it was at a store of this kind that a white man stopped in his car so that Alec, an African who was with him, could buy something. The white man waited, and presently Alec came out of the shop glowing with happiness, excited as the white man had seldom ever seen him before. All he could say at first was, "It's happened. It's really happened." And a little later, when he calmed down a bit, he explained, "I was waiting to be served when a European came in behind me. The shop assistant looked over my shoulder and asked what he wanted. And do you know what that man actually said? He said, 'Excuse me, but I think this gentleman was in front of me.'" In that moment, the ending of the book of Ruth was rewritten. A single voice of compassion spoke out against the system. One nameless man stood tall among people, stooped and crippled by their hatreds. If he and that long-forgotten author of the book of Ruth do nothing else, they keep our conscience alive and our hopes high, and they make us remember that the love of God knows no boundary of color, creed, or territory. The Bible, I remind you once again, is the Word of God for us only as it is rewritten and brought up to date on each day of our lives. Our part is to watch for that to happen tomorrow, the day after.